walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Ellie Lax, the founder of the Gentle Barn, a Southern California sanctuary that houses more than 170 animals that have been rescued from abuse, neglect, or slaughter. And one of those powerful instances of two-way healing, the sort of dynamic that we particularly celebrate on Talking Animals, those animals are visited and often cared for by inner-city at-risk and special needs children. This sort of dual mission very much reflects Lax's interests and passions and educational background, elements that propelled her towards founding the Gentle Barn in 1999, which relocated to a larger spread in 2003. 2 years ago, she opened the Gentle Barn's second location in Knoxville, Tennessee, with plans apparently to open many others across the country. We'll learn more about these plans and other aspects of the Gentle Barn when I speak with Ellie Lax here on Talking Animals in just a moment. Later, I'll speak briefly with journalist Bronwyn Dickey, author of Pitbull, The Battle Over an American Icon, a widely acclaimed book, racked up so many accolades it received 2 rave reviews in the New York Times. The book is now out in paperback. Lastly, I'd like to mention that we're less than a month away from the WM&F Summer Fun Drive, which starts June 1st, so that we and you can get a head start on the fun drive. I'm offering the opportunity to pledge today for a pair of tickets to see legendary punk band X May 14th at the State Theater. All these years later, they're still a fantastic, fiery live act. John Doe has been a guest on Talking Animals multiple times, including just a few months ago. And I'm seeking a very modest pledge of just $88.50 for a pair of X tickets. So email me at dj@wmnf.org if you're interested. Right now, though, let's get to Ellie and the Gentle Barn. With a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Ellie Lax back to Talking Animals. Good morning, Ellie.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining
me.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals. In fact, we spoke on the show about 5 years ago. But we have to assume not everyone listening now was listening then. So let's start with an overview of the Gentle Barn. What was your intent when you launched it in 1999?
So the Gentle Barn does 2 things. We rescue animals that nobody else wants because they're too old, too sick, too lame, or too scared to be adoptable by other agencies. And so we're a sanctuary for them. We get to bring them in, rehabilitate them with vet care, but also use lots of alternative methods to heal their bodies and their hearts, get them to a state of happiness and health. And then if we can find them homes, great, but if not, then we give them sanctuary for the rest of their lives. And then when they're ready, they help us with a second part of our mission, which is to help people with the same stories of abuse and neglect. So we do school field trips in the morning, teaching children kindness to animals. And in the afternoons during the week, we do groups of at-risk inner-city and special needs children.
Well, that sounds pretty good. And back when you did launch it in 1999, and even prior to that, in the run-up to doing so, how did you view other farm sanctuary-type facilities at the time?
Well, I mean, they're my colleagues. They're working for the same things that I am. So all the other farm sanctuaries out there are all doing their part to create more peace and health and well-being for animals and humans and the environment. So I'm really grateful for anyone out there trying to do good. At the Gentle Barn, I think that we're a little bit different than other sanctuaries in that we focus on children as well. So there's so many different ways that animal sanctuaries can run. They can be out in the middle of nowhere with lots of land, giving animals freedom. They can be near the city so that people can come meet the animals. And of course, they can bring in all kinds of animals. For my vision, when I was a child, I was very lonely, and animals healed me. And so not only did I want to pay it forward by saving animals and giving animals that had nowhere else to go a place to go, but I also wanted to embrace that circle of healing, not only for animals, but for other children like myself who was lonely and struggling and didn't know where else to turn. And so I think that that makes the Gentle Barn a little bit different than other sanctuaries, but all sanctuaries are doing their part to do good in this world, and I'm honored to work alongside them.
And how early did you, based on your history and kind of what was important to you based on your childhood, how early did you conceive the premise, basically sort of the two-pronged premise, I guess, in a way, of the Gentle Barn? I'm not only looking after animals that fit the description that you've already mentioned, but also that children would be very much served by the Gentle Barn as well.
The Gentle Barn was my dream since I was seven. I remember very clearly trying to bring home animals that I found that were lost or injured or hungry. And I just thought that I could have a house full of animals and I would save them and they would be my friends. And my parents were not amused. They didn't want a house full of animals. My poor mom had her hands full with me and my younger brothers. And so they would keep getting rid of the animals when I was at school, and I'd come home to find them gone, which was very painful. And I would say, how can you do this to me? And they would say, Ellie, when you grow up, you can have as many animals as you want. And I would yell back at them at 7 years old. I would say, you'll see, when I grow up, I'll have a huge place full of animals, and I'll show the world how beautiful they are. So it was like my temper tantrum, and it turned into a mantra, and it turned into my dream, and I just couldn't let go of it. I literally, when I was a kid, would sit in school, and I would doodle what the Gentle Barn would look like. And before I went to bed each night, I would envision what the Gentle Barn would feel like and what it would be like to be surrounded by all these animals that I would get to love and then work with to heal other humans. And so it was a concept that was derived many, many years ago when I was seven.
Well, that's, I think, one of the best outcomes I can think of for a temper tantrum.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. But yeah, it really does show that in one form or another, that vision. Because the thing is, it sounds like some of what you're describing was the story for many of us, which is you looked after animals that were sick or injured in the neighborhood and you bring them home and try to like fix them up. But this sounds like even at seven, this sounds like it went well beyond that.
Yeah. I have this theory that children know who they are and why they're here. And I think that they could get lost because school has other messages and their home life might have other messages, and they might, by the time they reach adulthood, have forgotten or got lost from that original vision. But I think that when we can stay out of children's ways and just follow their lead and allow them to be who they are, I think children have a pretty good grasp on why they are here. And so I was not supported in my dream, but I'm very, very stubborn.
Yeah.
And so for whatever reason, I was able to hold on to it. I mean, it took many years. It took me 30 years to start the Gentle Barn. It wasn't an easy overnight thing. But I just refused to give up on it, and I refused to let it go. And I kept working and working and working towards it, and I finally manifested it in 1999.
So when you first began, how many animals were there in the very sort of beginning of the Gentle Barn in 1999?
Yeah, so I was busy procrastinating, not knowing how to start my dream, and I actually ran across a petting zoo I'd never seen before in the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles. And so I stopped to go in just because there was a lot of animals and there was a lot of people and it smelled kind of funny, and I don't know, I was nosy. So I went in and I saw that the animals were really suffering there. They had overgrown toenails, they were dirty and matted. A lot of them were underweight. A lot of them were sick. There were injured animals there. It was just an awful place. And I couldn't stand the sight of that place. And so I was running for the door to get out of there. And blocking my way was a very old goat that looked me right in the eye. And I swear she said, could you please help me? Please, please help me. And she stopped me in my tracks. And I just couldn't bear the thought of walking out on her. And so I ended up going to find the owner and said, hey, can I have that goat? And she said, no. And I said, well, can I buy that goat? Name your price. And she said, no, lady, leave me alone. And I said, well, I have this feeling that if I leave, that goat's going to die. And so I'm going to stay here till you say yes. And I stayed there for 12 days. And then finally on the 13th day, she came up to me and said, lady, take this goat and get out of here. So I brought Mary home, Mary the goat. And I found a mobile vet to help me remove her tumors and trim her overgrown nails and learn how to feed her and love her. And a few months later, she was as happy as can be. And it was the greatest feeling in my life to have completed a rescue like that and brought someone back to life. It was a wonderful feeling. And I'd been calling authorities on the place to see if they can help make conditions better, but nobody seemed to be willing to do anything. So I ended up going back to the same petting zoo and said, listen, I have a little house with a half-acre backyard. I can bring home some animals that really need help. No questions asked. I'll take them off your hands if you have them. And she said, wait right here. And she brought in a whole pile out of animals with pneumonia, broken bones, scared to death. And I just brought them all home, and I fixed them one by one. And then a few months later, I looked out my window one morning to a backyard that was now full of animals, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. I said, holy cow, I just started my dream. So my dream started with a handful of decrepit animals saved from that abusive petting zoo.
Well, there's a few things about that story that I might want to go back and sort of comment on. First of all, as you might imagine, at least, with a show called Talking Animals, I, of course, immediately am struck by the fact that the goat spoke to you. So that's my kind of talking animal. And it also sounds like we're starting to see a bit of a running theme, because I wouldn't say this was an outright tantrum, much like when you were a little kid, but it sounds like, hey, I'm not leaving, mister, until I can walk away with that goat. Sounds like a similar kind of stubbornness to great effect.
I'm a little bit stubborn when I set my mind to something, yeah.
But again, to very good results. So now we've got this goat and some other animals from that petting zoo. Tell me about the first time an abused or neglected animal was paired with one or more of these kids, and what it was like witnessing whatever kind of profound alchemy that I'm sure must have taken place.
Yeah, you know, it was amazing. I dreamt of this union since I was seven, that I was going to bring these wounded children in to see these wounded animals. And it felt like such a brilliant idea in my mind. But I remember that very first time a group came out to the gentle barn shortly after I had started it. And I started to panic, like, oh my God, what if it's not a good idea? What if it doesn't work? What if the counselors laugh at me? What if the kids won't even go near the animals? And I started to panic, thinking, oh my God, what have I done? What if this is a terrible idea? And I was very nervous, and I remember they came in, and it was a group of foster children, and they parked the bus in front of my house, and they all clambered off the bus and onto my property. And I remember there was one child that was about 11 years old, and everything about him was just angry. He walked angry. He looked angry. His whole face was scrunched in anger. His arms were folded angrily over his chest. I mean, everything about him just oozed anger, and he caught my attention right away. And the first thing he did when he got on my property and the kids were waiting to start and waiting for everybody else to exit the bus, he picked up a rock. He saw a spider up under the rain gutter of the awning of the house. He picked up a rock and he immediately threw it at the spider. And the counselor swooped in and said, I knew you wouldn't behave. I knew we shouldn't take you. You're going to sit the rest of the time on the bus. And they whisked him away to punish him on the bus. And I ran after them, and I said, wait, can I talk to him a minute? Would you mind? And they said, oh, we're just so angry. We're so embarrassed. We're sorry. We shouldn't have brought him. He's prone to these outrages and outbursts. We're so sorry. And I said, no, please, would you give me 5 minutes to talk to him? And they were like, yeah, whatever. And so I kneeled down on his level, and I said, hey, I saw that. I saw you throw the rock at that spider. That was an amazing throw. You've got a good arm. And he kind of looked at me in disbelief because he thought I was going to scold him.
Yeah.
And then I said, you know, I can imagine how that spider felt. I wonder if you can. Can you imagine being so tiny and small and little and having these huge people walk around you and you're trying to hide and you're trying to wish that you were invisible, and all of a sudden one of them sees you and he's throwing things at you and you're powerless to do anything about it. There's nowhere to hide. There's nowhere to run. You feel like your life is going to end. I was like, I wonder if you can imagine how scary that might be. And this little boy's eyes filled with tears immediately. And the reason I had posed that question is because I knew that he knew what that felt like. These are foster kids. He came from enormous abuse and was finally removed from the home. And, you know, of course, he's taking his anger out on a little spider or anyone he can. But I posed that question because I knew that he knew what that felt like, to be so little and so vulnerable and so scared and having nothing to protect yourself. And so his eyes flooded with tears, and his eyes met mine for the first time. And he said, yeah, I know what that feels like. And I said to him, so how about instead of taking our anger out on others, what if we would protect them like we wished we were protected? You know, we are that spider. You know, I was feeling very vulnerable and scared when I was a child, and imagining you were too. We're the same as that spider. What if we could protect that spider like we wish somebody had protected us? And he got really, really excited. And then so then I asked his counselors, can he please just do the tour with me? And for the rest of that day, he became the little police patrol over the animals. And he would tell the other kids, hey, hey, Ellie said walk, don't run, it'll scare the animals. Hey, hey, you're talking too loud. Ellie said talk softly, we don't want to scare the animals. And I remember towards the end of the group, there was a little mouse hopping around the barn in one of the stalls. And I remember kind of motioning to him to sit down next to me and watch that little mouse. And he became the protector of that mouse. He made sure that everybody was quiet and sat down and didn't scare him. And, I mean, he just changed on a dime, because instead of wanting to take his anger out on others, he realized that he was the same as others. And so on a dime, he changed to be their protector. And I think that that lesson probably affected him for the rest of his life, in terms of instead of being the bully on the playground, now he was protecting the weaker kids on the playground.
Wow.
I remember when that group left that day, I remember thinking, wow, this stuff really works. Like, being with animals and connecting children with animals really works. And it was just such a high. It was a wonderful feeling. We've been doing it for 18 years now.
So really, if I follow you, it sounds like that instance with that boy was where you thought, okay, everything that I kind of had conceived and hoped to do, and it took me a while to get here, but I'm seeing it in action and it's working.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I remember how nervous I was before that group and thinking, oh my God, what if I'm wrong? What if I'm just crazy? And just seeing it in action and seeing the light come on in that little boy's head and his heart open wide and seeing the connection between him and everyone else where he had no connection before. He was angry. He was acting out on everybody. He was getting into trouble every single day. The counselors were so frustrated with him. And just seeing his life be able to shift and change forever, really. Very rewarding.
For sure. Well, let me let folks know, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Ellie Lax, the founder of the Gentle Barn, a Southern California sanctuary that houses more than 170 animals that have been rescued from abuse, neglect, or slaughter. If you'd like to ask Ellie a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. And we do know that there have been a little brief intermittent trouble with the on-air signal and or the online stream, but as far as I know, I think both are now back up functioning properly. So thanks for your emails. So Ellie, as you mentioned, you've been doing this now for 18 years. What are some of the most notable ways that Gentle Barn has evolved and changed over those years in terms of how it operates or what kind of animals you bring in or what kind of kids you bring in?
Yeah, I think that we've grown a lot. It's been an incredible journey. You know, when I first brought that little Mary goat home from the original petting zoo, I knew that I loved animals and I had a very profound connection to them, but I didn't know how to heal them or what to do when they were sick or scared. I was kind of running on instinct and relying on the veterinarians to teach me. And over the last 18 years, we have learned so much on how to heal animals, and we've developed our own gentle healing method, where we use a combination of course, vet care, but we also use acupuncture, acupressure, chiropractic, deep tissue massage therapy, ultrasound, ice therapy, water therapy, energetic healing, nutritional supplements, and lots of love in our own patented holding therapy method. And over the years, we've gotten so good at it. With each case that came our way, we've learned so much that we've become really good at healing animals, especially from puppies from parvo, and cows from veal crates, and baby animals that have nothing to live for, no will to live, and have a really high mortality rate. We have really fine-tuned methods to be able to heal them, and we have a huge success rate now where we can take animals that the veterinarians are saying, oh my God, you should put this animal down. There's no way they're going to make it. And we can take them into the Gentle Barn, and by using our gentle healing method, they make it and they thrive. So that's really rewarding. The other thing that we've really gotten good at is not only healing animals, but helping them live a long time. So the Gentle Barn animals live way beyond their life expectancy.
Give me an example of an animal, what the normal life expectancy would be and what their life expectancy at the Gentle Barn is.
Yeah, so, I mean, pot-bellied pigs live typically till about 15. We just said goodbye to Lily, a pot-bellied pig, who lived till 27.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a big difference.
We live till around 15-ish. Our dogs live till 18, 19, 20. Same with cats. Farm pigs is another thing. Because farm pigs are genetically engineered to get very big, very fast,
yeah,
so they can go to slaughter when they're babies at 6 months old, when we rescue them, they grow till 3 and they end up being 1,000 pounds. And so by the time they're 4 or 5, they can't walk anymore. And so the typical life expectancy for a 1,000-pound farm pig is about 4 or 5. We have toyed around over the last 18 years with diet, with exercise. We use a product called Sun Chlorella Algae Superfood that boosts their immune system. And all of that combined, and of course lots of love, and all of that combined, we have 3 farm pigs that have just made it to 10.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds amazing, and it does sound like it is a combination of things. And one of the things, too, that you mentioned as you were outlining some of the general healing methods was your patented holding therapy method. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so we rescue dogs, and again, we rescue dogs that no one else, we rescue animals that nobody else wants, and so the dogs that we take in are either very, very old, arthritic and incontinent, or they're very young and dying of parvo. So we get a lot of calls from animal shelters with parvo puppies. And at first, we helplessly watched as they just died one by one. I mean, parvo is just so impossible to beat and so horrible. But I thought a few things about that. I thought, okay, well, first of all, you're taking a very young puppy who should be with his mom but doesn't have a mom. So in the big scope of things, you're dealing with someone very young that doesn't have a lot to live for. Then you're dealing with someone who has a compromised immune system, so how do you boost the immune system? And then, so I thought, okay, well, if we can find a way to boost their immune system and keep them hydrated so they can make it through the illness, that would be step one. So we found Sun Chlorella Algae Superfood, which boosts the immune system, and even though they don't want to eat and they're throwing up and they have diarrhea, the Sun Chlorella Algae Superfood goes into their system and at least gives them the nutrients they need to survive. And then, of course, sub-Q fluids to keep them hydrated. Okay, so that's step one, just kind of making it through physically through the illness. But that's not good enough because you can give all the physical necessities to a puppy, but if they don't want to live, they're not going to. So we had to do something to give them something to live for. And so I reasoned, well, when you take a puppy who doesn't want to live and feels terrible and you put them in isolation in a veterinarian cage, they're not going to want to live. They're not going to have the strength to pull through that. So what can we do to nurture them, to love them, to give them something to live for? And so I came up with this idea to just take these puppies and just hold them 24/7. Sleep with them, hold them during the day, not let them isolate, let them sleep on our chest so they can hear our heartbeat and our breathing, and let them know that they're not alone, give them the warmth and the nurturing that they need to develop a want and a desire to live. And so we tried that. So the 3-part combination for curing parvo is Sun Chlorella Algae Superfood, sub-Q fluids, and just holding therapy. We literally don't put them down. I mean, obviously we put them down to go to the bathroom. But other than that, we just hold them. And we have gone from losing a lot of puppies to developing this method to having 100% success rate. I remember we rescued 200 dogs from a hoarding situation, and we had 45 puppies that were all dying of parvo. And the veterinarian said, you should euthanize them all. They are all very, very sick and lethargic. They're just not going to make it. And so we said, well, we want to try our method. So we brought them all home. We had all these puppies all over the house. It was a pooping nightmare, but we got volunteers in. We held them 24/7. We put them in foster homes so that people could hold them in their beds. They weren't in cages. They weren't in isolation. They were literally held 24/7. And during this method, within 48 to 72 hours, they are completely symptom-free.
Wow.
Yeah, so I'm really proud of that because, you know, people get these shiny little fluffy little puppies, and they're so in love with them. And if they take them from the animal shelter, they have a high rate of coming down with parvo, and people spend thousands of dollars, and then they lose their beloved puppy, and it's just horrible for everybody involved. So coming up with this method and being able to save them, and the puppies going on to have these rich, wonderful lives, it's very rewarding.
God, that's pretty remarkable. I mean, it sounds like it really is a combination of a lot of things that are tangible and not so tangible that go into that kind of healing.
Yeah.
And so, Ellie, what is your criteria for accepting new animals at the General Barn? I mean, I assume at least you don't have the space or resources to accept every animal you hear about that needs a home or needs your help. So how do you decide, okay, yeah, we can do this or we can do these over here?
Yeah, it is hard to decide. Well, the majority of the calls that we get are from people saying, you know, oh, I'm moving, I'm getting divorced, I lost my job, you know, I can't keep my animal anymore. And so we have a big referral program where when you're trying to place a horse or a dog that's placeable and adoptable, we refer them out to other agencies so they could be rehomed. When we get the call about an animal that there are no options, there are no other agencies to take them, they are not adoptable, veterinarians have given up on them, and we know that we can heal them, we just make room. So, for example, we had this horse named Sir Lancelot. He had come from severe abuse. He was almost ridden to death and beaten and just horrible. And the Los Angeles Police Department went in and confiscated him and brought the man to jail. And they brought this horse to the animal shelter. Well, the horse was 21 years old. He was just a bag of bones. He had no muscle. He was lame. He was not rideable. And so after 3 months of holding on to this horse, the animal control finally said, look, we got to euthanize him. And when he was scheduled for euthanasia, the LAPD officer that had pulled him out of the cruelty case got so upset. Like, I saved that horse. I didn't save that horse to be put down. You know, she had, like, a personal connection with him because she had pulled him out and saved him and looked into his eyes and made promises to him. So she found out about us and called and said, look, I'm begging you to take this horse. And so we didn't have really any room. We didn't have the funds to treat him. But we knew that he would be euthanized. There was no other horse rescue that was going to take him. The vets had given up on him. He had no other resources. But we knew with a combination of the things that we use to heal animals, we could really help him. And so we went on Facebook, actually, and we asked our fans to support us. We said, look, if you help us financially, we will make the room and we will do the work. And our fans came through. We raised enough money. We brought him in. We gave him acupuncture, chiropractic, deep tissue massage therapy, and ultrasound. We gave him really high-quality food. We gave him some chlorella algae superfood. We gave him lots of love and nurturing and brushing and hand-walking. And his therapy took a year, so it was a long time. But after a year, he was sound. He was a good weight. His coat was shining. His eyes were bright with new hope. He joined our herd. He got a girlfriend and best friends, and he is alive and well today at the age of 31.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. And I have to say, Ellie, a lot of these stories are tearjerkers, and I don't think I'm alone based on some of these emails I'm reading. Let me just read a couple, and then I'm going to get a caller involved. But let me just quickly let people know again that I'm speaking with Ellie Lax, the founder of The Gentle Barn, and we do invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. But among the emails, one says, hi, so happy to hear more about The Gentle Barn. Great organization. The story about the little boy really got to me. Thank you for your great work. Another one says, is giving a nice plug for finding out more information. It says, to see Ellie and Gentle Barn, go to byutv.org. And I guess it's Turning Points, or the name of the show. It's season one, I guess, from February 2012. So
yeah, thanks.
Right, let's get a call involved here. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Ellie Lax.
Hi, good morning. I just turned in and heard you talking, and it brought to mind a situation that we're going to be up against soon. In our building, I've been feeding a feral cat the last year, and through, you know, food and everything else, they've got where I can pet the cat. But, of course, it's a feral cat, and you can't tame an adult feral cat. You just do the best you can. The problem is we're getting ready to have the building tended for termites. Now, this cat spends most of its time sleeping in a chair in our little patio area or living under the building. And I'm pretty sure that this tenting is going to kill the cat if she's there when this happens or she comes in shortly thereafter. And to trap the cat and then to keep it in a cage for, I don't know, 24 or 48 hours in a small little cage, to me is almost inhumane. It would drive the cat nuts. Is there any facility or any place that helps out in situations like this that could temporarily put the cat in a much larger space until it's safe to go back in under our building?
Yeah, absolutely. I would suggest reaching out to cat rescues in your area. Any cat rescue worth their salt is very familiar with feral cat situations. And so they'll be able to help you trap him, but maybe contain him in a more humane area, like you said, for the 24 or 48 hours that the building is being tented. And when it's safe, they can help you set up a feeding station for him. Well, it sounds like you've already done that, so that he kind of live the rest of his life in your building but not be hurt. I would contact a cat rescue in your area and ask them to help you.
Just start with the shelters in the area and go from there.
Yeah.
And not the shelters. I wouldn't go to the shelters.
Yeah,
because first of all, they're not going to help you. And if they do, for some reason, like if you trap the cat and bring them into him, they're just going to destroy the cat. I would contact the private cat rescues in your area.
Okay.
Right. And they can help you get the trap and teach you how to trap and when to trap and what to do with him once you've trapped him. And then how to release him once the tenting is done.
Yeah, that part I'm familiar with because a previous feral cat we took down and had her spayed and released later, but this is a new one. And, yeah, it would just freak her out totally if she had to be in a cage, a tiny little trap cage, for that amount of time. This cat would be just untamable after that, I'm sure.
Well, I think Ellie's giving you great advice. You really got to contact a cat rescue as opposed to a shelter, and they will help you, I'm sure. But thank you so much for your call. We do have to move on. Thank you.
Good luck.
All right, appreciate it.
Ellie, among other emails that have come in, one says, just the subject line, there's no message actually inside, it just says she's a godsend to all animals, and then one, you've inspired so much that it sounds like there may be a cross-country relocation in the picture here, because this one says, hello, I love the show, I'm interested in employment at an animal sanctuary, I recently started volunteering at my local animal rescue in Manatee County, I am willing to relocate, what do you recommend I do, thank you so much.
Oh, that'd be great. Well, just if you could send an email and your resume to info@gentlebarn.org.
And by the way, I guess I should probably almost goes without saying, but the website to find out more about Ellie and all her work and the Gentle Barn itself is simply gentlebarn.org. So Ellie, before we run out of time, we have a few minutes left, and I definitely want to get into something else that I find pretty interesting and certainly happened since we last spoke, is the notable development really of opening a second Gentle Barn in Knoxville, Tennessee. Tell me about that. What was the impetus?
So my dream is to have a Gentle Barn in every state in America. So there have been times we did a rescue in South Carolina, and I went to the board of directors and said, hey, can we open in South Carolina? And they were like, no, we're not ready. And then later we did a rescue in Kentucky, and I said, hey, can we open in Kentucky? He said, no, we're not ready. So over the years, we have tried to open in other states. Well, 2 years ago, it was my birthday, and my husband is usually very generous to me on my birthday, and I said to him, for my birthday this year, I don't want anything. I just want to rescue a cow. I don't want a party. I don't want gifts. I don't even want a card. I just want to rescue a cow. So he said, well, okay. So we just kind of assumed we'd rescue someone local, maybe some field calves at the local auction or somewhere local. Well, a few days later, we got a call from a woman in Tennessee that said that there was a cow there that had lost his foot, that he was failing in a horrible way, that nobody in Tennessee seemed to be able to help him, and that he was going to go be put down soon, and is there any way we could help? So my husband researched to see if there were bovine surgeons in the area, and there were, and then he researched to see if there was companies that could make prosthetic legs for cows, and he found several. And so he came up to me and said, well, happy birthday, we're going to Tennessee to rescue a cow. So we ended up going to Tennessee to rescue this cow, bring him to a hospital. He had multiple surgeries. We fitted him with a prosthetic foot. He did really well, and after 5 months, he was ready to leave the hospital. And we were going to bring him back to California, to our sanctuary here, but we went to the board of directors and said, can we open in Tennessee as a home for Dudley the cow and for all the other animals that we could rescue there? And they said yes. And so we finally opened the second Gentle Barn in Knoxville, Tennessee. Next month, it'll be 2 years, exactly. It's been doing really well. We have visitors literally from all over the world. We have Dudley the cow still doing very well in his prosthesis, but we also have a whole slew of other animals. We have horses and pigs and chickens and turkeys, and they're all doing very well, and it's just beautiful there. And we just did a rescue in St. Louis. I don't know if your listeners have heard about the 6 cows in St. Louis that escaped a slaughterhouse, and we stepped in to save them. And so my husband is in St. Louis as we speak looking at properties, so who knows? We might be starting a Gentle Barn in St. Louis. Keep our fingers crossed.
Here's the thing, Ellie. I mean, when you say in every state in America, and just to hear what you just described about what's already happened with the one in Knoxville, I assume you're not exaggerating. There's no hyperbole here. But, I mean, how would that really work? I mean, I guess part of my concern is, and I'm sure people listening to this interview feel that you're an extraordinary person and you've done an extraordinary thing. But here's, I guess, would be my concern, especially if, I mean, it's one thing to have another one in Knoxville. But if you really started to have a general barn more and more, and then really in every state across the U.S., I mean, often founders of successful enterprises, whatever they are, restaurants, stores, other things, including, I think, sanctuaries, et cetera. A lot of that, when they're successful, it's because of one person, maybe two people, but usually one person and their vision, and they have just sort of something magical about them, and that's why that thing has succeeded. So what often happens is when you see those people do expand to other locations, sometimes it works, but sometimes there's the difficulty of being spread too thin, or it's hard to duplicate other elements, including even kind of staff and other human parts of the equation. So how would the general barn overcome these obstacles and avoid those kind of pitfalls that do seem to dog a lot of efforts like that?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And it's one that I've been trying to answer, and I'm going to continue trying to answer over the next several years. It is hard to duplicate kind of who I am and what I know. My entire life and my childhood and my experiences have all added up to shape the person that I am, to know how to heal animals and see children and do our work. And so that is a really good question. How do I duplicate who I am and what I know into other people so we could effectively open other gentle barns? And it is a challenge. But I have fine-tuned exactly the type of person I'm looking for to run a gentle barn on my behalf. And it's someone who is very compassionate, yet a good leader. It's someone that loves animals but doesn't judge other people. It's someone that simultaneously has so much compassion for animals and people and children. And I'm bringing in people as we speak to work with me so that I can start training them and shaping them, molding them to run gentle barns. We're going to pace ourselves. We're going to take it slow. I'm not going to all of a sudden open 50. We're going to open one at a time. And I'm doing it with people that I've worked with and I've trained, and they really understand the heart and the soul of the gentle barn. And I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess I can better answer this question 10 years from now.
Okay, well, that brings me to one of my last questions. Then we're unfortunately are sort of at the end of our time. But what is there a projected timetable? Not necessarily for one in every state, but do you have kind of a plan? Like, okay, by this year I'd like to have 5, and by this year I'd like to reach 10, or some sort of specifics in that way.
I would like to open a gentle barn, and I know this sounds really aggressive, but it would be great if we could open a gentle barn like one a year, or like one every other year.
Okay. Well, that is ambitious. That is ambitious.
Well,
yeah.
Remember how stubborn I am. So
yeah, no, believe me, my money is on you. I think if there's one thing we've learned here. Okay, well, cool. We'll kind of track that, and obviously we'll check back, and we'll have another conversation in a couple years or so and see how many gentle barns there are. And obviously, if that's what's going to happen, I particularly would like to lobby for one being in Florida sooner rather than later. But
that'd be great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Ellie, thank you so much. We've been speaking with Ellie Lax of the Gentle Barn. Again, the website is gentlebarn.org, and thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals, and obviously for all the great work you're doing there and in Tennessee and pretty soon everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Bye.
In a few moments, I'll talk with writer Bronwyn Dickey about her extraordinary book, Pitbull, The Battle Over an American Icon, which is now out in paperback. Right now, it's time to step into the comedy corner with a piece that has at least a partial connection to my conversation with Ellie Lax. This is Kevin Nealon with a piece called Cows on the Roof in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals.
Most animals are smart, though. You know, I remember during the tsunami in Sri Lanka, I read about this. The animals, they have like a sixth sense. They knew it was coming, and they took off for the hills the day before it happened. They all survived. They didn't tell anybody else. They kept it a secret. They said, come on, just us. Come on, keep it quiet. Move it along. Let's go. But I have a whole newfound respect for animals now. I give them a lot more credit. In fact, now when I see a dog chasing a car, I will chase that car too. Oh, yeah. Animals are something. I rescued a couple of cats not long ago. Hey, do your cats throw up all night long? Is that what they do? Is that the MO? I mean, all night long, all I heard was, whoa! And I wake up in the morning, and there is puke everywhere. It's like living in a fraternity house or something. You know, it's just crazy. And you know what? Not even puke. They're hairballs. And I know that because I sifted through it with a little stick. A couple of berries, but mostly hair. Mostly hair. Yeah. And you got to get it off the carpet quick, otherwise it stains. You've got to make a decision. Either get them off or let them accumulate and become like a sticky shag carpet after a while. Animals are smart. That's all I'm going to say. I watch the Weather Channel. They always show the floods in the Midwest, right? And they show the cow up on the roof, you know, surrounded by water. I don't know how she gets up there. I guess she comes up the stairs, I guess. Do they have stairs in a barn? I don't know. She comes up the stairs, crawls out the window, grapples up to the roof, just waits it out. They should show that. Maybe they should have the Cow Network. I'd watch the Cow Network. But even here in California, you know, the animals warn you before an earthquake. They'll start barking like crazy. The dogs, you know, the cats will hide under the cars. You just have to know the signals, what to look for. Okay, like if you live in the Midwest, right, and you're going down the stairs and there's a cow coming up the other way, you get the boots. It's common sense.
That was Kevin Nealon with a piece called Cows on the Roof, taken from his album Now Hear Me Out. Now on to my conversation with Bronwyn Dickey. Indeed, let's welcome Bronwyn Dickey back to Talk Animals. Good morning, Bronwyn.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals.
Thanks for having me.
Partly, or mainly, I guess, for having this conversation because Pitbull, the Battle Over an American Icon, is now out in paperback. The book is chock full of info, and many of us who thought we knew a lot about Pitbulls learned a great deal about the dogs, their history and behavior from that book. So with the benefit of some time and distance, what's the biggest thing you learned from writing the book?
I think the biggest thing I learned, besides that all these kind of widely accepted beliefs about dogs are actually wrong, we're relying on folk wisdom a lot of the time, was that specifically with pit bulls, this issue is really more about people, groups of people hashing out their issues with each other than it really says anything about dogs or dog behavior. So looking at through it, especially through the lens of having the book come out over the past year and seeing the reaction to it, mainly it was extraordinarily positive, but there were, you know, some people who really kind of got their dander up, not to mince words, about it. That really kind of showed me that the thesis of the book was right. It really was about people hashing out their issues with each other.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit more about that, because the book tour appeared to be kind of, for example, a sort of singular, often harrowing experience, because, I mean, there'd be, every day, there'd be a new, like, rave review, in many cases from some of the top publications I've mentioned a couple times on the air today. I mean, the New York Times reviewed the book twice, and two different critics, and raved both times, and that's just an example. So these things would keep coming out, and yet, this was back when we're on Facebook, and maybe we'll come back to it. I guess why you're not. But anyway, you know, so there'd be these great reviews, and then there'd be some report, usually from you, sometimes from a friend, of like some crazy thing that happened at a book reading or a book tour appearance.
Right.
And to what extent now, again, with some distance, were you surprised by that, or does that kind of fit in with what you just said about these sort of erroneous things that people have absorbed as factual when it comes to pit bulls?
Right. Well, I expected a little bit of it because part of my research over the 7 years I was researching the book, I really wanted to understand how people talked about the dogs amongst themselves. And so that meant reading tons and tons of message boards and comment sections and Facebook group dialogues and all that to kind of see what, not just the conversation that people were having with me about the book, which might be one thing, but the conversations they were having with each other. And sometimes those would get incredibly heated and deeply personal. And so I understood that there was a lot of that going on, and I expected some pushback from some people, but I did not expect kind of the obsessive persecution, kind of the attitude of persecution that this small group of people who really hate these dogs, that kind of thing. I did not expect them to be as obsessive,
yeah,
kind of as they were. But as you said, what was really kind of shocking or illuminating, I guess, was that when people actually read the book and they engaged with what I said, they really enjoyed it. And they they saw that I wasn't just trying to paint everything with a rosy picture. I wasn't just rushing, you know, advocating that people rush out and go get a pit bull, or I wasn't trying to push the dogs on people who didn't want them. Nothing of that sort. And the scientists who read the book really respected it. That was very important to me, that I get the science right. So that was great. But then the people who didn't, who just saw the word pit bull, they erupted. And so, yeah, there was one situation where a guy came to my reading and kind of asked repetitive, disruptive questions, and the store actually called the police to get me a police escort from the store, which was odd. And they were sending hate mail to the bookstores where I was reading. They were calling the bookstores where I was reading. They were trolling their social media sites. And, you know, it was just very, very strange, because this wasn't, it very quickly transcended a conversation about dogs, and it became this, like, persecution of me, which was just strange. But it does kind of confirm the whole thesis of the book, is that this is about human projection onto animals. It isn't about the animals themselves.
Right. And the fact that people get so charged, these readings sound like that one in particular you mentioned, but others too sounded very emotionally charged at times. And again, I think you said kind of the key point a moment ago, which is that from what I can gather, and I probably from what you could gather, a lot of these people, like the guy that was so disruptive that you needed a police escort and others, never really bothered to read the book, yet they were outraged by it. So
right.
I thought, okay.
And many of them admitted they hadn't read it. They said they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't deign to dignify it by reading it. But it just goes to show that those two words, pit bull, have become so controversial for people and so emotional, and they attach so many values to those words and kind of a whole identity around those words, that just seeing them can make people kind of see red in a way.
Yeah. Well, and again, part of the thing, as you noted, I mean, you researched this thing for 7 years, and there's tremendous history, and there's also tremendous science. And so part of this, I mean, then and maybe even more now, as it turns out, it just seems to tie into the people who do not accept science. And
right.
Whether it's climate change or pit bull related science or any kind
right.
of science, it's like, sorry, do not confuse me with facts. I'm just mad about this, or I'm just dismissing it. And it's pretty remarkable. So just one other sort of maybe tangential thing related to that is, so after you finish the book, I think, and after you finish the book tour, especially, again, you know, normally a journalist and write for all kinds of great publications. So you went on this conspiracy cruise and wrote a piece on that, which, if I'm not mistaken, also elicited some very emotionally charged responses.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I began researching conspiracy theories and conspiracy psychology when I was researching the book, because there was so much overlap. There were people who really hate pit bulls, who kind of believe that there's this shady cabal of, I think, dog fighter funded shell groups or something, and that I was secretly working for dog fighters, or they kind of believe that there's this shady cabal controlling animal welfare. And so that's how I started researching conspiracy psychology. And then I found that, lo and behold, there was an entire cruise for conspiracy theorists. So it was everything from the faked moon landing or JFK's assassination to vaccines supposedly causing autism, which they do not. All these things kind of converged in one place. So I pitched that to an editor friend of mine at Popular Mechanics, and they sent me on this cruise. And at first it was very fun and interesting, kind of like an X-Files fan club or something in a way. But then it started to get a little darker when members of the cruise started kind of turning on each other and then turning on me, thinking that I was somehow working for the CIA or the Qatari government. I was never quite sure who they thought I was working for.
Wow.
And then they started kind of getting very angry and upset that a member of the press was there, even though I had told them from day one who I was. I didn't keep anything secret. But kind of seeing that play out was really, really interesting. But I always like to say many of the people on that trip were very, very nice to me. And so I don't want to paint them all with that brush.
Right. But we just have a few seconds left. So based on that experience, and it seemed like you were also kind of got some kind of crazy responses then and later. So I'm guessing you still love pit bulls and dogs generally, but how are you feeling about humanity these days?
I do love dogs generally, though. I'm always careful to say the lesson of the book was I don't put one type ahead of another.
Yeah,
I think by far we are the most confusing, complex, and dangerous species out there.
Okay.
And we have a lot of reflection to do about ourselves in terms of the way we treat each other in all fora, but certainly online fora, the ways that we try to disrupt other people's lives. It's one thing to say, you know, this isn't for me. That's fine.
Yeah.
It's another to say, this should not be for anybody. And I want to destroy you for existing.
Yikes.
That's weird.
All right, Bronwyn, well, we're out of time, but again, the book is out in paperback. It's Pitbull, The Battle Over an American Icon. Bronwyn Dickey, thank you so much. It's Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Thanks.
Thanks, Duncan.